This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Doug Henwood for a second political analysis from the socialist left on where we're at and what we can do. Last week, we spoke with Chris Hedges. This week, Doug Henwood. We speak with Marjorie Cohen, the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a constitutional litigator. We speak about the forthcoming election crisis and what might be the end of capitalist democracy.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The word chaos best describes the current American public health, economic, race, and political situation. America leads the world in the number of COVID-19 cases and in the number of deaths, which are now exceeding 200,000 with no end in sight. 400,000 deaths are predicted by January 1st. Trump lies when he promises the quick development of a vaccine. He attacks the head of the Center for Disease Control and advises not to wear masks and leads huge rallies of maskless supporters. The economy is a disaster. Perhaps 20 million people are unemployed. Small businesses are shuttered. The economic stimulus package has run out. Millions face eviction. Hunger is rampant, especially amongst children. Democracy and the rule of law is being trashed. Trump has cast doubt on the efficacy of the upcoming election, first suggesting that it be postponed, then advising his supporters to vote twice, and assuring people that unless he won, the election would be fraudulent. He has indicated that if he loses the election, he will not vacate the White House on January 20th. Despite the unprecedented mass demonstrations of perhaps 20 million people in June in the streets, the cops continue to murder people, especially black people, with impunity. The Republican convention put forward no platform to address the catastrophe. Trump spoke at it for all four nights, presenting himself as the solution for all of America's problems. The best that can be said about Joe Biden is that he's not Trump. He's run a lackluster campaign and now finds himself neck and neck with Trump, who got 60 million votes in the last election and whose popularity remains undiminished. We speak today with returning guest Doug Henwood. Doug Henwood is an economic, finance, and political analyst. He is the host of the radio show Behind the News. He's a contributor to Jacobin Magazine and a contributing editor to The Nation Magazine. His latest book on Hillary Clinton is called My Turn. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be with you.
And Doug, I want to apologize to you and to our listeners in advance. I'm recording this remotely, and I've got a talking parrot, Charlie Parker, who may pitch in during the course of this interview. So if you hear a bird in the background, that's the explanation.
That might be amusing. Welcome any intervention, avian intervention.
Doug, you've written that now is the time for socialists to think big. What big ideas do you think socialists should be advocating now?
Well, you know, we're in the midst of a deep economic, health, political, social crisis. So I think thinking big at this point is almost practical because we're in such a deep, multiple crisis. But I'm thinking about the kinds of things that we need to do to get out of these multiple crises, large health interventions, large economic interventions, and for the longer term, you know, the climate. We're speaking just after the massive fires in the West, hurricanes in the Gulf Coast. The climate crisis is upon us. So we have, you know, the COVID crisis right now, but then the climate crisis is sort of a background for all this as well. So I'm thinking of several things we need to do. On the health issues, we just need a really, you know, rational single-payer health system, but also the public health system, infrastructure of the country. The pandemic revealed just how broken everything is. Hospitals are in the wrong places, the wrong kinds of equipment, the wrong kinds of priorities in the healthcare system, where you know, elective surgery for rich people is more important than basic public health interventions. We were unable to do a proper test and trace routine for in a lot of areas because we just had an under underfunding basic public health functions for so long. So that, you know, that's extremely important just to get our way out of this crisis and to deal with ones in the future. The climate crisis is almost certain to bring about more pandemics, so we need to be prepared for that. But also the Green New Deal, both parts of it, the green side and the New Deal part of it, the green part to address the climate crisis. And the New Deal, because we need a redistributive social policy and the creation of a healthy and civilized, robust welfare state. We saw over the summer the expanded unemployment benefits and the one-time $1,200 checks kept people from going under, kept the economy from going under, and kept millions of people from starving. Now the $1,200 checks are, you know, a fading memory. The $600 supplemental unemployment insurance benefits are over. We're getting slight increase from Trump's ridiculous executive order, but these are pretty tiny numbers. So we saw this massive social welfare intervention in the form of the CARES Act that was actually quite successful. It kept the economy from completely imploding and kept people from utter penury. And now that's all gone. We have unprecedented numbers of people going to food banks, you know, still, despite some recovery in the job market, massive numbers of unemployed, whole industries in deep crisis. So we need to first, you know, address the immediate concerns of people who just have no money to pay the bills. We're on the verge of an eviction and foreclosure crisis. We need to address that. But we also need to think about restructuring the economy in a sustainable way for the long term. We have whole industries that should not be revived, like the airline industry and the fossil fuel industries. And we need to create whole new industries of clean energy, clean transport, in order to sustain life on Earth. So, you know, the combination of the ambitious climate program plus the ambitious social spending program that sails under the name the Green New Deal, I think these things are eminently practical at the moment. You know, remember when Nancy Pelosi dismissed the Green New Deal as the Green Dream, whatever? This sort of thing seems like very, very practical policy right now, and we should be pushing hard for it. I think to the point where even Joe Biden has adopted some of the Green New Deal, which is quite a shocker.
Doug Henwood, you're a member of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. What are the short and long-term goals of the DSA?
Well, I think there are a couple. It depends upon, to some degree, on to who you talk to, because it's not a line organization. It's not some, Marxist-Leninist organization. But in the short term, there's a lot of emphasis on electing candidates at the local level, a lot of organization around that, but also organizing around issues, immigrant defense, tenant protections, that sort of thing. The longer term, many people, when I wrote an article for the New Republic like a year and a half ago about DSA, and I talked to a bunch of people, and there are quite a number of people who see it as some sort of, in the jargon of the trade, a pre-party formation. That is, they get a lot of criticism. A lot of people criticize DSA for running candidates on the Democratic line in primaries and cooperating with Democrats. But this is what people, I think, a lot of people don't understand, is that this is a purely opportunistic strategy. The ballot laws in this country are so skewed towards a two-party system that it has almost a quasi-legal status. That, you know, we're not a one-party state, we're a two-party state. But so it's very, very hard for third parties to get on the ballot. The Green Party has been trying this for 25, 30 years and has gone nowhere because the two-party system has really made it very, very difficult to break in. So running DSA candidates in Democratic primaries has turned out to be quite a successful strategy. Five members of Chicago City Council. We're now in New York State. We're going to see a socialist caucus in the state legislature in the next session, five or six members. That's a very important thing. But the longer-term idea is to build a mass organization that is united around a common strategy, a common agenda of creating social democracy in the United States, and over the long term, you know, moving towards some kind of socialist model of public ownership. It's mostly a young membership. I'm really a geezer when I go to these meetings. But I'm just blown away by the seriousness and discipline and decency of everybody involved in it. People really treat each other in mostly collegial ways, and it's really quite moving. And the seriousness, the kind of the level of political education, the level of discipline and organization. And the meetings run on time, too, which is just an amazing thing for anybody who's been involved with the left for a long time. So, yeah, I think there's this combination of just the practical thing of running candidates, more and more candidates at local levels in the short term, and then really building this thing for the long term to bring social democracy and socialism onto the American political agenda.
Why was Trump supported by some 60 million people in the 2016 election? And why has he continued to receive that kind of massive support?
Well, you know, this is a really complicated problem. I mean, people talk about Trump's base. I think there is not one single Trump base. I think there are several dimensions to it. One is traditional Republicans who just want tax cuts and deregulation. That was an important part of his constituency in 2016. Some of those folks are wavering in 2020 because he's such a vile character and it really puts them off. But then, you know, of course, there are also outright racists, white supremacists, you know, neo-Confederates and vile people of that sort. And then there was this kind of free-floating group of people who just were really mad at the system and wanted to give it the finger. That constituency, the give-it-the-finger constituency, may not be so important this time around because Trump has now been president for over 3.5 years. He is now the establishment. It's pretty funny that he's blaming Joe Biden for all the problems and disorder that you know, we've seen in recent months, when in fact it's Trump's America. He's the one who provoked protest and riot and just the kinds of disorder that he seems to think he can cruise to re-election on. Well, there is certainly a portion of the white population that is motivated by racism and xenophobia, really violent contempt for anybody who has sympathy for other people, really anti-solidaristic, very selfish kind of view of the world. And that's an important part of the Trump base. And then there's, you know, classic Republicans, classic conservatives who just think that somehow Biden is a socialist and he's going to expropriate their property. It's not very convincing because that's not who Biden is, but I guess there are enough people who believe that to make it somewhat credible. I think it's a combination of these things. People who want low taxes and don't want to give any money to poor people, traditional Republican politics, with the additional seasoning of deep racism and contempt for people weaker than themselves. That's a big constituency in American politics, unfortunately.
Many people have called Trump a fascist. Others point out that many of his supporters are fascist-minded, while others explain that Trump is a Bonapartist figure who stands above and mediates between classes. Do you believe it's helpful to call Trump a fascist?
I don't know. I think that gets to be almost a theological dispute, whether he's a fascist or not. I think that there are a lot of dissimilarities between classic European fascism of the 30s and the kinds of politics that Trump represents. You look back at the Hitler days. Within 2 weeks, the parliament passed the Enabling Act, which made Hitler into a dictator, essentially. And people, communists were thrown in jail, union organizers were thrown in jail almost overnight. And, similar with Mussolini. They moved very quickly, whereas Trump has very big problems with administration and detail. But on the other hand, he does appeal to, he's got a deep authoritarian streak, a deep streak of grandiosity on his own, and he does appeal to a bunch of people who have those sorts of politics, white supremacists, armed white supremacists. We've seen the Proud Boys across the country, the Patriot Prayer up in Portland. We've seen a really disturbing alliance between those forces and local police departments. We've seen the videos of the Proud Boys yucking it up with the Philadelphia police over the summer. There's a lot of evidence of substantial friendship between the Portland police and the Patriot Prayer crowd. So that's kind of scary. I mean, that's the militia side of fascism, which seems to be present, or at least in Chrysalis. But there's also an awful lot of opposition to this. It's hard to say that it's not that kind of European fascist takeover that people seem to think that this is a rerun of. You and I would probably be in jail if this were a real fascist state. But there are disturbing authoritarian tendencies in Trump and among his supporters, and violent tendencies among Trump and his supporters. So, yeah, it's scary. And I wouldn't want to get hung up on the word fascist, but it is violent, repressive, and authoritarian, and racist. So it's a scary package, whether you want to use that label or not. Sam Moyne, law professor at Yale, makes the argument that calling Trump a fascist has several limitations. One is that it underestimates, it makes him sound like a foreign import. It underestimates the degree to which we've created this imperial presidency over the decades. And his kind of deep Americanism, he's a huckster, he's a xenophobe. And these are, you know, deep things with deep roots in American history, the huckster xenophobia complex that Trump exemplifies. The other thing is that we will, if we think of Trump as a fascist, he somehow seems like a temporary aberration, and that if Biden were to win, become president, we'd all wipe our collective brow and say, you know, we dodged that bullet, he's gone. But, you know, these are all deep problems in American society that produce Trump, and if we get rid of them, they're not going to go away. The kinds of divisions, the downward mobility, the hatreds, these are all really, you know, deep, run deep in American society. And to think of Trump, you know, he's a, the way I like to talk about Trump is that things have always been bad and he's a turn for the worse. If we remove the turn for the worse, we still got to worry about the structural bad.
Yeah, precisely. I would just add that not only would you and I, Doug Henn, would be in jail at this time, but the radio show that we're doing now, Law and Disorder, wouldn't be on the air. Trump has the power to pull the switch and turn off all alternate media. That scares me. But Doug Henn, I wanted to ask you about the debate that's coming up between Trump and Biden. Trump supporters will be watching and listening to the debate and to the criticism of Trump. If you were advising Biden, what would you tell him to say in order to teach these people, understanding that you really cannot criticize Trump to them? What positive ideas would you put forward?
Well, Biden has to make some appeal to, or at least address the concerns that people have about being broke, about being, you know, this pandemic which Trump so badly managed. We have to have some sense of how to get out of this. And, you know, that Green New Deal agenda I was talking about earlier would have to be an important part of it. Now, people, if you poll people on things like Medicare for all, $15 an hour minimum wage, job guarantee, those things all poll very well. When people like Trump start applying labels to it, that sort of distracts attention from the real content. So Biden has to offer some kind of policies that would make people's lives better in the short term and the longer term. And he also has to, and this is going to be a hard thing for a guy like that to, he's just not he's not that kind of guy, but he has to inspire people, give people hope that we are just so awash in despair and anxiety that we need some kind of, you know, distant horizon that would, like, that we can aspire to. And that's, Sanders was able to communicate that. Biden can't, because that's just not the kind of guy he is. He comes out of really technocratic, centrist, democratic politics. But he has to do his best to give people something to hope for, because right now things seem kind of hopeless. When I was doing that article for the New Republic on DSA, I talked to a bunch of younger people who are involved in it, and one of the things that really disturbed me, I would ask, look, I asked a lot the question, what's the long-term goals of DSA? And one person I talked to said, well, I'm not sure there is a long-term. Like, there's this sense of doom that climate crisis and social collapse mean that there's no future for a lot of younger people. And that's just a really frightening and depressing thing for young people to have no hope at all for the future. Seems to be a symptom of a really severe crisis. We need to address that. That kind of, you know, that constellation of emotional and political factors that lead to that kind of despair.
Let's talk about the American capitalist economy. Was it in bad shape before the onset of COVID-19? Was the plague just a trigger?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of things wrong with it. There is even in good times, the American economy doesn't provide a lot of people with a decent standard of living. They're just even last year, 2019, by most conventional measures, was a very good economic year. The unemployment rate looked low. The wages were picking up to some degree. Poverty rate was low. But still, there were just millions and millions of people who couldn't pay their bills, millions more who couldn't afford $400 if in emergency expenses because they don't have any savings. People were cycling in and out of bad jobs, and corporate America was not really investing in much of anything. They were really rolling in profits, but they were rather than investing in doing R&D and hiring people like they're supposed to, they were just shoveling trillions of dollars into the pockets of their shareholders. And so when we hit this recession, an awful lot of corporate America was had very bare coffers because of that waste. So the airline industry in particular, or Boeing also, these are two sectors that have been in terrible trouble because of the pandemic. But they entered the pandemic with much weaker financial state because they had wasted so much money on share buybacks rather than investing in their underlying businesses. And we've learned how badly Boeing botched that 737 Dreamliner. They were so busy sending money to their shareholders they forgot how to make a safe airplane. There's a whole lot of structural problems with the American economy going into this. And then, the polarization, the insecurity, the lack of a decent welfare state. The pandemic revealed all that in very stark view. People, I think there's been a partial recovery in some of the conventional economic indicators. So the starkness of that has been receded somewhat. But, yeah, people are still doing quite badly. And, there's some really deep structural problems with the economy that have just not been addressed. Trump's trillion-dollar tax cuts goose things up a bit. The underlying fundamentals were just not all that healthy.
You think the economy is in worse shape now than it was during the Depression in the 30s?
Well, yeah, in the sense that in the Depression of the 30s, we're at least in the middle of the decade. We're making investments in the long term, in the infrastructure. Now, the public investment in this country is like, if you take just a lot, once you deduct depreciation, the wear and tear on public assets, public investment has been close to zero. Just everything it feels like everything is falling apart in the United States. In the 1930s, under the New Deal, we were making big investments in the public infrastructure, roads, bridges, public buildings, environmental investments through the WPA and associated programs. And we're not doing anything like that at all now. We're if anything, just cutting public spending, the kinds of austerity that we're seeing at the state and local level. It's just leading to a very dramatic rot in our public infrastructure. So instead of accelerating those sorts of investments to encourage economic recovery and to assure long-term prosperity and in a sustainable sense, we're not doing any of those things. We're just giving money to rich people to get richer. This has been a great time to be Jeff Bezos, but it's not been a great time for anyone else. Anyone else who needs to go to a public school. I mean, we look at what the school's trying to cope with the pandemic now. They're certainly in New York City, but across the country, they just don't have the buildings, the staffing, the ventilation systems. Just so much that's absolutely falling apart that a civilized government would take this opportunity, this economic crisis, they would see it as an opportunity to make those kinds of investments for the long term. But we're not doing that sort of thing at all.
We're speaking with Doug Henwood. Doug, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We've got another 4 minutes or so. But let me ask you this. If Biden gets elected, will we actually change things with respect to employment or health or the systemic racism that we suffer, the nuclear buildup, the climate crisis, of course? If he gets elected, will anything change?
Well, I would say if left to his own devices, things would change a little. Under Obama, we're not doing enough for the climate crisis. Under Trump, we're making it actively worse. I mean, like drilling in the Arctic and things, you know, like lifting all these regulations pollution regulations, land use things. You know, Trump has been an absolute environmentally destructive philistine about these sorts of things. I think that Biden would probably reverse the worst of that. But that's why I said left to his own devices. But I would hope that a Biden presidency would be somewhat more responsible to pressure coming from his left. And unlike 2008, 2009, you know, the Obama years, there is now a substantial left presence within the Democratic Party that could have an effect on policy. One of my long-term obsessions now is the rot of the American ruling class, which seems like a completely decadent social formation. I think a mature ruling class would actually have some kind of approach to the climate crisis. It wouldn't be our approach to the climate crisis, but it would be something. We really don't have much of anything coming out of at the elite level. And, you know, you look at the Republican Party, it's just nothing but a Trump personality cult now. And political parties are really important for developing class agendas. The Democratic Party, you look back in the 90s Democratic Party under Bill Clinton, these are not good ideas, but they, you know, the DLC and that kind of business-friendly Democratic Party, Democratic Leadership Council kinds of politics that Trump, that Clinton transformed the party with, they at least had some ideas. They were not good ideas, but they had some ideas. The current Democratic Party just has nothing going for it. It's hard to think of anything that either the Hillary Clinton campaign or the Biden campaign or the, you know, these wings of the Democratic Party, the Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi wing of the Democratic Party, these people have no ideas about how to do anything. So there is at least, you know, a vacuum there, and maybe we can take advantage of that because the energy and the ideas within the Democratic Party are only coming out of the left of the party, and the center and right wings of the party are just brain dead. So my only hope is that Biden would be somewhat more responsive to that kind of pressure, whereas, you know, Trump would be actively hostile to it.
Doug Henwood, I want to thank you for this excellent interview. But before I let you go, how can people follow your work?
Well, I do a blog occasionally, lbo-news.com, and also on Twitter, unfortunately. Doug Henwood is the my Twitter handle. But anything I write or do on my radio show is publicized on that blog, lbo-news.com. So if you want to know what I'm up to, that's the place to go.
Thanks, Doug. You take it easy. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
What if Trump is voted out of office on November 3rd, but on January 20, when he is scheduled to vacate the White House, he refuses to go? His lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, predicted this in his congressional testimony before he went off to prison. Trump is already casting doubt on the legitimacy of the election, which is less than 2 months away. He says there will be massive voter fraud, that absentee balloting, which will be widely prevalent because of the COVID crisis, is easily open to fraud. Can Trump send federal troops to Washington, D.C. or other cities? Can he deploy the National Guard of the various states? Can he suspend habeas corpus, arbitrarily detain people, or declare martial law? Can he investigate opponents, freeze their assets, control communications, initiate a foreign crisis, or get help from Attorney General William Barr? And what can we do about this? We speak today with Attorney Marjorie Cohn. She's the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. Attorney Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Marjorie, do you think that Michael Cohn was right when he predicted in his congressional testimony that Trump would not peaceably leave office?
Oh, man, I hope he was not right, but a lot of signs point the other way. Trump preemptively sowing doubt about the election, suggested delaying the election, suggested sending federal troops to the polls to police non-existent voter fraud. And Trump declared on the first night of the RNC, Democrats are trying to steal the election. The only way they can take this election away from us is if it's a rigged election. And when Chris Wallace asked him on Fox News Sunday in July, are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election? Trump replied, no, I have to see. And he's also tinkering with the Postal Service, which is sacrosanct. He admitted that he's blocking emergency funding for the Postal Service and said, well, they don't have the money to do the universal mail-in voting. He's worried that the mail-in votes are going to go for Biden. And his new Postmaster General, who has incredible conflicts of interest, instituted several changes that have slowed down mail service, including the removal of 671 sorting machines, and that since June. So I hope that Michael Cohn is wrong, but I fear that he may be correct.
So what might unfold on January 20th if Trump doesn't vacate? What are the various scenarios?
Well, it's frightening, Michael. Under the Presidential Succession Act, if there is no clear winner by January 20th, and even if Biden is the clear winner, if Trump doesn't vacate, the Speaker of the House becomes president. That's Nancy Pelosi, of course. But would the Supreme Court ratify that if Donald Trump challenged it? You know, the Supreme Court is very precariously balanced, tipped to the right. although John Roberts is concerned about his legacy. He's not just a radical right winger. He also has this legacy to protect and at least the appearance of impartiality. Hopefully there won't be armed fighting in the streets because Donald Trump, you know, his supporters are not just armed, they're armed with assault weapons. So your guess is as good as mine, but hopefully it will not come to that.
So can Trump send federal troops into Washington, D.C. like he did the last time? Or can he send them into other cities?
Well, each state has its own National Guard, and every member of the National Guard is a member of the Army Reserve, and each member of the state National Guard wears two hats, state and federal. Now, generally, members of the state National Guards are under the command of the governor of their state, but once they're called into federal service, they cease acting as agents of the state and they become armed forces of the federal government. Except for the National Guard of Washington, D.C., which is the D.C. National Guard, and in that instance, the president, not the city's mayor, is the commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard. Now, the D.C. National Guard has been used regularly. Most members of the state National Guard have been mobilized by the respective governors when they are mobilized. And in Washington, D.C., they are acting under the direction of the president. But I guess the short answer to your question is yes.
Can Trump use the National Guard from one state and send it into another state without the permission of the governors of either state?
I was actually answering that question just now. In terms of generally sending, and he can, when he's the commander-in-chief of the state National Guard, he can certainly deploy them where he wants. In terms of sending federal troops into Washington, D.C. and other cities, he sent them to Portland, he sent them to Wisconsin. He was about to send them to Chicago when actually it was, I'm proud to say, the National Lawyers Guild and Black Lives Matter Chicago and other plaintiffs, but notably the National Lawyers Guild, who filed a lawsuit to prevent a Portland-style occupation, federal occupation of Chicago. And they were successful, I think, because although Trump did send some agents into Chicago, they were assigned to already existing cases, FBI, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Drug Enforcement Administration. So there was nothing like what we saw in Portland. But he did not invoke the Insurrection Act, which, you know, if he did, which he might do after the election, to get the military out into the streets, then that triggers other powers, I think, which we can talk about.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the what they call PEADS, P-E-A-D-S, Positive Emergency Action Documents. Do these allow for suspension of habeas corpus or arbitrary detention or the declaration of martial law?
Well, it's interesting, Michael, because these PEADS are Presidential Emergency Action Documents, which originated with President Eisenhower to deal with the possibility of a Soviet attack during the Cold War, and they have purported to authorize unconstitutional actions, including the suspension of habeas corpus, the declaration of martial law, and rounding up people with no legal basis at all. It's arbitrary detention that you mentioned. These PEADS are so secret that not even Congress has seen them, but Freedom of Information Act requests have occasionally led to the revelation of their contents in public sources, and PEADS could presumably provide Trump with an unfettered opportunity to employ authoritarian, even military tactics in order to maintain power.
What about voting with absentee ballots? Are absentee ballots really open to massive fraud, as Trump repeatedly alleges?
No, they're not. It's a red herring. In fact, when his campaign was pressed in a lawsuit to reveal evidence of voter fraud, they couldn't do it. But expect him to raise unsubstantiated claims of voting by undocumented immigrants, foreign governments, Antifa, which means anti-fascist, his boogeymen that he pulls out to solidify his base. Trump he has said that mail-in voting is fraudulent. He tweeted, with universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, and of course mail-in voting and absentee voting are the same thing, but Trump tweeted, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. And, of course, you know, he lobbed that out there. He has no authority to delay the election. But also, he said, he tweeted, must know election results on the night of the election, not days, months, or even years later. He's banking on the absentee ballots not being counted by election night, which they won't be. And there could be up to 40% of people voting by absentee ballot because they don't want to catch COVID by going to the polls. And if it looks like there's a false tally where it looks like Trump is leading on election night because the absentee ballots and the mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, haven't been counted, he could declare victory. I think that's what he's setting up. Also, the intelligence and election security officials said that mail-in voting is safe from foreign intervention, that we have these things in place. And by the way, after taking office, Trump established a controversial presidential commission to study voter fraud, you know, this red herring. The commission met twice before disbanding, never produced any evidence of widespread voter fraud in U.S. elections.
Would you please, Marjorie Cohn, about the Transition Integrity Project. What is it? What scenarios do they lay out? And what conclusions do they come to?
The Transition Integrity Project, or TIP, is a bipartisan organization of campaign chairs, academics, and former government officials. It was established last year out of concern about the manipulation and disruption of the 2020 presidential election and transition. And in June, TIP conducted election crisis scenario exercises called Preventing a Disrupted Presidential Election and Transition. in order to identify risks to the rule of law or the integrity of the democratic process between Election Day and Inauguration Day. TIP assembled a group of more than 100 experts for the experiment, and their report that they issued called the results alarming. They assessed with a high degree of likelihood that November's elections will be marked by a chaotic legal and political landscape, and Trump is likely to contest the result by both legal and extra-legal means in an attempt to hold on to power. They said that they warned about an unprecedented assault on the outcome of the election, and they also disturbingly warned the potential for violent conflict is high, particularly since Trump encourages his supporters to take up arms. Now, TIP developed four scenarios as follows. Number one, the winner was unknown the morning after the election and the race was too close to call. Number two, Biden won outright the popular vote and the Electoral College. Number three, Trump won the Electoral College by a healthy margin but lost the popular vote by a healthy margin. And four, Biden won both the popular vote and the Electoral College by narrow margins. So these are the four scenarios that TIP developed, and then they did exercises to flesh out what would happen in each of these scenarios. In all four, Trump cast doubt on the official election results. The second scenario, which is when Biden won outright the popular vote and the Electoral College, initially showed Trump alleging massive fraud, demanding investigations, and appealing to the media to cast doubt on the result. He later accepted a loss once it became clear that his attempts to overturn the election results would not succeed. So that's really the best scenario. In the fourth scenario, which is Biden wins both the popular vote and the electoral vote by narrow margins, Trump would not concede. He set up a fierce competition that ended with an uneasy and combative but ultimately successful transition. So that's kind of the second best best scenario. In all four scenarios, Michael, Trump encouraged violence and chaos in the streets. His strategy called for recounts, investigations into voting, quote, voting irregularities to undermine public confidence in the results of the election, trying to stop the counting of mail ballots, even ordering Bill Barr, his right-hand prostitute, who runs the Department of Injustice, even ordering Barr to seize mail ballots, organizing his base to take to the streets, relying on right-wing media, Fox News, et cetera, to sow chaos and intimidate officials to side with Trump. And where he trailed in the popular vote count, Trump challenged Biden to prove a negative that there had been no voting fraud. The participants in these TIP scenario exercises were particularly concerned about the president's ability to federalize the National Guard, deploy the military domestically, launch investigations into opponents, freeze their assets, and even control communication in the name of national security. Barr could provide legal cover for the president. And the report from TIP cited Trump's prior appeals to Second Amendment people to defend their rights and his calls to supporters to liberate states with restrictive COVID rules. Trump could initiate a foreign crisis after the election or during the transition period. Barr might launch a bogus investigation of so-called terrorist ties of members of Biden's transition team to justify surveillance or a false flag operation before the election or in the contested period after the election.
Trump used to brag, this is about a year ago, that he had the bikers on his side, that he had the cops on his side, and that he had the military on his side. I'm not sure that's true, particularly after the Jeffrey Goldberg piece in The Atlantic to show how Trump ridiculed the military. But what do you think the military might do in the scenario?
It's very hard to say, but Trump might order the military into the streets to quell protests after he tries to hijack the election. And the question is, you know, the military service members under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and Army Field Manual have a duty to obey lawful orders. but that also means they have a duty to disobey unlawful orders. And it may be that military leaders and or service members, this is hopefully, will disobey Trump's illegal orders to go into the streets and, you know, protect his hijacking of the election. Veterans for Peace, and I'm proud to say that I'm on the board of advisors of Veterans for Peace, has urged service members to disobey unlawful orders, reminding them of that. So your guess is as good as mine, but I'm not sure, I'm not confident that the military would obey those unlawful orders.
What about the Republican legislatures in the swing states? What if they refuse to certify a Biden victory?
They might do that. The Republican state legislatures in potentially decisive electoral college states might simply refuse to certify a Biden victory because Trump is crying fraud. That could be Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin. They might either withhold electoral slates or install their own slates. And so that is a possibility.
What about Trump using the COVID stay-at-home order to prevent protests?
Well, Vanita Gupta, who's the former head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, has worried that Trump could weaponize COVID and use it as a pretext to issue stay-at-home orders to prevent people from going to the polls when the deadline for requesting absentee ballots has expired. You know, Michael, he's already declared a national emergency because of COVID, and national emergencies give the president all kinds of scary powers, basically. The National Emergencies Act triggers more than 100 additional powers for the president. He can order the closing of any, under the Communications Act, he can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communication. That could include television, radio, and the internet. He has tremendous powers that he could marshal if he thinks that he might lose, because as I'm sure you know, Michael, there is nothing that Trump hates worse than losing, and he will do anything to maintain power. Legal, illegal, doesn't matter to him.
Can he shut down the internet?
Yes, he can, under the National Communications Act. He can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communication, and there are scholars such as Stephen Rohde, who I think was on your show, said this on Law and Disorder, that this Communications Act could empower him to shut down television, radio, and the internet. He told you that it can give a president a virtual kill switch. Remember that?
I do remember that. What about Facebook and YouTube and Twitter? What role might they play, and what can Trump do to them, and what can they do to Trump?
Well, Facebook is already taking steps to counter false claims of victory on Facebook by Trump supporters. It's planning for what to do if Trump tries to invalidate the election results with accusations that the Postal Service lost mail ballots or other groups meddled with the vote. Facebook has considered a kill switch to stop political advertising from spreading misinformation after Election Day. Twitter and YouTube have also considered actions they might take after the election, although they haven't specified what those would be. And according to Alex Stamos, a former Facebook executive, he told the New York Times, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter have to potentially treat the president as a bad actor. So there you go. I mean, it's nice to see Facebook stepping up to the plate for democracy for a change.
Yeah, except that it's a two-way street. They could also use it against the left, so it's worrisome. We're speaking with Attorney Marjorie Cohn, constitutional lawyer, former law professor, and an expert on this. Marjorie, you wrote a very good article in Truth Out. Can you tell our audience how they could get a hold of that article?
Yes, it's on truthout.org, and actually, if you go to my website, marjoriecohn.com, it has that article and the other articles and books and video things as well, but that at this point is the top article, first article on my website, and it's from Truthout. I link to Truthout, but I have it posted on marjoriecohn.com.
and that's Cohn spelled C-O-H-N. Marjorie, what can be done to safeguard the elections? What can people do now?
Well, there are grassroots state and county coalitions with special focus on North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. They need state coordinators and local activists, poll watchers. There can be lawsuits filed, and there already have been lawsuits filed. Protect Democracy filed a lawsuit to force the Postal Service to disclose its plans for the election. And we can also expect to see additional lawsuits by the National Lawyers Guild and the ACLU, who filed lawsuits to prevent the president from sending his federal forces to Chicago, and also to prevent his federal forces from targeting journalists and legal observers. The National Lawyers Guild is famous for our legal observers who provide witnesses to police brutality, and we also provide legal defense for protesters who are arrested. There will be lawsuits to protect mail ballots in various states, and there have been. In Tennessee, they won. In Kentucky, they won. There have been lawsuits in Wisconsin, South Carolina, to protect voter registration databases, et cetera.
So what are your thoughts about this? Stepping back, you've been a political activist for many decades. You've been a constitutional litigator. What are you thinking about where this country has come to at this point?
Oh, man, it's very, very frightening, Michael. There have been, of course, many bad presidents in the past. There have been notorious war criminals. I wrote extensively about the Bush administration and their illegal wars and war crimes and torture. I also wrote about Obama, who sent drones to kill people illegally in seven different countries and increased illegal surveillance. But Trump really kind of takes this to a new level because there's no pretense of following the law, to say nothing of tradition and culture and all of that. And you never know what he's going to do next. And just when you think that you've seen the worst outrage, then he does something else. Nevertheless, he has this pretty firm support among his so-called base. And the polls are very close. Now, I don't know about the polls. They were not right about, the 2016 election. But I really think that the DNC made a mistake in their convention by not appealing to the youth and to the progressive wing. And I think that it's going to be really a challenge to get young people out to vote. There's so much, negative publicity out there about Democrats. And of course, there are a lot of problems with the Democratic Party. I think Biden's a terrible candidate, probably the worst candidate. But I am working like crazy to defeat Trump. And that means voting for Biden-Harris. Much as that's distasteful, we've got to get Trump out of there because Trump is making the lives of people in this country and around the world miserable. And when he has no check at all, assuming that he even has a check now because he's already got a second term, if that happens, who knows what he would do. So I think that the real challenge is going to be to get progressives out to vote for Biden and Harris. And there are many people at Roots Action, et cetera, that say, well, if you're in a safe state, you can vote for whoever you want or not vote or write in Bernie. I think that is, that maintains credibility with progressives. But on the other hand, I think that unless Biden wins not just the Electoral College, but the popular vote by an overwhelming margin, and even if he does, Trump is going to cry foul and do everything he can to legally or illegally, and probably illegally, try to maintain power.
Well, on that somber note, Marjorie Cohn, I'm afraid that we've run out of our allotted time, and I'm going to have to say goodbye. But a really heartfelt thank you for your hard work and your ability to articulate the situation so well. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael, and keep up your great work as well.
You take it easy. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.